Before we start our episode today, this is just a reminder. History Hack does have a Patreon account and all of your donations are gratefully appreciated. There's lots of perks on there, secret groups on Facebook. Do get involved. We would love to see more of you. Enjoy the episode today. Hello and welcome to another episode of History Hack. I have a sneaky suspicion that Zach is very excited today. Zach?
See, not quite for the reasons that you're expecting, though. I've hoodwinked you slightly on this one. So today we are talking about Mexico's last emperor. And a little guy called Napoleon is going to feature, but not the Napoleon that I'm usually banging on about as Alex rolls her eyes.
Grandson, right?
That's right.
Grandson? Yeah.
So Napoleon III is going to feature in this story. To talk us through it, we have Edward Shawcross with us. Edward is a historian and a teacher, and he's the author of a new book, The Last Emperor of Mexico, A Disaster in the New World, which is out already in the US, and by the time this goes out, will be out in the UK as well. Ed, welcome to History Hack. Great to have you. How are you doing?
Fantastic. Yeah, really well. Lovely to be here.
Do you know what I love is the smug expression on Zach's face, because Zach likes nothing more than the French, a story of the French cocking things up.
They definitely don't come out of this one well, I'm afraid. It's not another fillip to the Napoleonic legacy.
Okay, so Napoleon III, this is. So set the scene for us, for listeners who aren't familiar with the period. When are we talking about, and what problems does Mexico experience post-independence? And why are the French even involved, I think, as well?
It's a fantastic question. But well, let's start with Mexico and then we'll bring the French in. Yeah. So Mexico becomes independent. It's part of the Spanish Empire, and it becomes independent in 1821 after a brutal war of independence that lasts 11 years. Now, unlike most Latin American countries that become independent at the same time, Mexico is quite unique. It becomes independent as a monarchy, as a constitutional monarchy. So an independent hero here is a guy called Iturbide. He actually was a royalist fighting with the Spanish, changes sides and manages to unite the disparate groups fighting against the Spanish behind him. And he does so by declaring Mexico, as I say, as a constitutional monarchy. Now, there's a problem in that he invites as monarch Ferdinand VII, King of Spain, or one of the members of the Spanish royal family. Ferdinand VII wants nothing more, other than the complete reconquest of Mexico, because it was one of the richest parts of the Spanish Empire. And so you have this seemingly insoluble problem in Mexico. You have an independent constitutional monarchy without a monarch. Iturbide's solution is simple. He crowns himself emperor. And emperor here is just a title. It's not that Mexico rules countries beyond its borders. It's a title won up from king. Now, this does not go well. He lasts 9 months on the throne. He's deposed, forced into exile. In 1824, he thinks he's going to be welcomed back as a hero. That's a mistake. He's actually executed for treason. So then Mexico becomes an independent republic, i.e. there's a president and no monarch. But the story of independent Mexico throughout this period in the 19th century is not a happy one. It's very unstable. Governments come and go, very rarely peaceably, always in violent revolt. The ballot box is not as important as your military prowess, as whatever faction is competing for power. The other thing that makes Mexico unique is its proximity to the United States of America. And this is key to why the French are going to get involved. In 1846, the United States of America invades Mexico in the US-Mexican War. It's a disaster for Mexico. The Mexican army loses every battle it fights, and it ends with US troops marching into Mexico City, this magnificent capital. And unfurling the stars and stripes over the main square. Now, what this means is that the only way that Mexicans can get the United States of America to leave is by signing away half of its national territory. So this is places today such as California, previously part of Mexico, after this, this war, taken by the United States of America. So great question. Why does France get involved? Well, this is not viewed particularly well in Europe, and not just in France. Or Britain's very suspicious about growing US power. But what France sees is a Catholic power, Mexico, losing territory to a predominantly Protestant nation, the United States of America. And this sort of cultural hegemony that Catholicism has, that to some extent Europe has had in Latin America, passing to the United States of America. Now, Napoleon III, we have to talk about him, and not least because Zach will be delighted to do so. He's the nephew, in fact, of the original and much better known Napoleon. And so 1848 is the year that the US-Mexican War ends with that peace treaty I mentioned where Mexico has to sign away half its national territory. There's revolution in Paris, of course, there is. That's always the case in the 19th century. A republic is proclaimed, a monarchy has fallen, and there are elections. And those elections bring back the first ever democratically elected president of France, that some listeners may be surprised to know, is a Bonaparte. And this is Louis Napoleon, the nephew, as I say. Now, any self-respecting Bonaparte is not going to be happy being a president for long. Unfortunately, the constitution prohibits him being re-elected. It's only a one-term office. So he does what his uncle did. He launches a coup d'etat. This is actually his third attempt to seize power. The first two have been absolutely farcical. And if we had more time, I'll go into them. The third one is successful, not least because he already holds, you know, positions of power. He gets the army on board. And so he essentially takes over the state. And within a year proclaims himself emperor of the French and has fulfilled his lifelong goal, which was to emulate what his uncle did. And if people have heard of Napoleon III, it's often because of this famous quote by Karl Marx, who says the first time is tragedy, the second time is farce. That's actually talking about Napoleon III's coup d'etat where he takes over power. And there's this idea that Napoleon III is farcical and his regime is farcical. And it's certainly not gone down well in history. But in the 1850s, it seems incredibly successful. The French economy is booming, infrastructure is being built, railways expanding. And in the international scene, France's isolation after the Vienna settlement and Napoleon I's humiliation seems to be ended. Napoleon III allies with the British, defeats the Russians in the Crimean War, defeats the Austrians in 1859. So in a sense, to use an anachronism, France has been restored to superpower status, and Napoleon III casts his eye across the globe. Where else can he increase French power and prestige? Mexico is the place that he alights upon.
See, listeners will be absolutely baffled by the idea that somebody with the surname Bonaparte might be inclined to just ride roughshod over a constitution and do what the hell they want and proclaim themselves kind of supreme leader, you know?
Who'd I do love so it? Far. We've had a couple of people in this story, though, that just go, right, we need an emperor. I think I'm the best person for the job. I can get on board with this. I now declare myself Empress of History Hack. So there is no constitution.
That's all it takes. That's all it takes. Self-confidence and belief.
See, does this make me the kind of little prime minister who gets executed for incompetence?
Fuck no, nothing can get done if I lop your head off. You're my little Stilicho. There you go. Look, there's a reference to yesterday. I did learn something from that incredible but very complicated Roman podcast. So why do Mexicans think that firstly, I'm really interested by the fact that they lost so much territory, because it makes the Zimmerman telegram in World War One not seem quite so batshit crazy, doesn't it? The one where Germany's like, well, we'll give you Arizona, New Mexico. Yeah. They're like, great, we're getting our land back. It's not just insanity. But why do Mexicans think that a monarchy is the solution to their problems?
Right. Well, the first thing to say here is that it's only some Mexicans, a small but influential minority, part of a political party in Mexico called the Conservative Party. They see what happened in Mexico, the years of political instability and indeed the humiliation at the hands of the United States of America, as a consequence of what happened at independence. So when Iturbide claims the crown for himself, this for them is Mexico's original sin, because they argue that Mexico has always been monarchical. It was monarchical under the Spanish Empire. They invoked the Aztecs, which of course was a monarchical system. And they say that it took a wrong turn because of Iturbide. And this is what happens if a Mexican general assumes the crown. That's a dictatorship. It's not a monarchy. What should have happened is that a European aristocrat of royal blood could have brought all of the pomp and ceremony that one needs to run a well-organized constitutional monarchy. And all of Mexico's political instability stems from that. Now, what happens in the 1850s and early 1860s is there's a civil war in Mexico between these two factions. There's a liberal group. They're led by a man called Benito Juarez. Benito Juarez, his belief and his followers' belief is that actually Mexico's problems have nothing to do with the fact it's not a monarchy. It's because it's not modern enough, it's not liberal enough, and there's institutions like the Catholic Church still have such a sway over politics and people's beliefs that it just can't modernize. So what they do is they launch a series of secular reforms, stripping the Catholic Church of its lands, which similarly to actually what happened in the French Revolution, and trying to bring in a much more modern secular vision for the state. Now, they would say they were dragging Mexico kicking and screaming into the mid-19th century. The people who are being dragged kicking and screaming, the conservatives, don't like it. So they fight the civil war, but they lose. They lose that civil war. It ends in 1861 with Benito Juarez's forces entering Mexico City. And our story really should end there. It doesn't. What happens is that these Mexican conservatives go into exile, and they go into exile in Paris, which is a very nice place to be exiled, I imagine. They have the ear of Napoleon III, and they have the ear of Napoleon III partially through his wife, Eugenie. She is a Catholic and she's Spanish, and she has a sort of nostalgic view of Latin America as an area of you know, sort of lost to Spain with Catholicism, you know, in danger. These Mexican exiles, they talk to her, they say, look, in Mexico, there's huge support for monarchy. It will restore Mexico to greatness. Not only that, if France lends us support, then France will also, of course, have an enhanced position, because it will be seen as a sort of hegemonic power, if you will, in Latin America. And that phrase, Latin America, is really interesting. It's first used in the 1850s in Paris, in fact. And one conception of Latin America, why it's called Latin America, the Latin part of it, is that Southern European influence of Catholicism and cultural history that some argue, especially Mexican conservatives, mean that Mexico is much better suited to monarchy and much better suited to cooperating with European powers like France, rather than the United States of America, which is Protestant and has shown itself to be extremely aggressive and hostile. Napoleon III is, as I'm sure Zach will know, an interesting figure. He, because of the collapse of his uncle's empire, he grew up in exiles and moving around various places in Europe and got involved in revolutionary societies in Italy, something of a romantic, but a gambler as well, a conspirator. He's happiest in smoke-filled rooms, making secret deals. And so this is the perfect secret deal for him. Why not support a bunch of exiles with regime change? They say that the monarchy is popular. They're going to do most of the fighting. So we can turn up in Mexico after the civil war and fairly easily launch regime change, install an emperor. And once again, another glorious moment for this French Second Empire. So that's why he gets behind the project.
So we know now why Napoleon III is drawn into it. Let's talk about Maximilian, kind of a little bit about his character, his background. Why does he choose to accept the throne? And also, what role does his wife, Carlotta, play within this?
Right. So, of course, this once again, we're presented with this problem that the monarchists had right back in 1821. It's a great idea to have a monarchy. You need a monarch. So the man who they alight upon is Ferdinand Maximilian. To introduce him, he's a Habsburg. So you don't get posher than a Habsburg. If you are looking to set up a monarchy in the 19th century, having a Habsburg on board is ideal. So he's an attractive candidate from that point of view. In terms of his personal character, he's the younger brother, well, a younger brother of Franz Joseph. Franz Joseph becomes emperor of Austria in 1848, such a seismic year, 1848, I always think. And now they formerly, the two brothers, Maximilian and Franz Joseph, had a close relationship. But when Franz Joseph becomes emperor, that changes. Franz Joseph has to put affairs of state above those of family. And Maximilian, he's ambitious, but he's also dangerous to Franz Joseph. He's much more liberal. He's much more gregarious. He's much more outgoing. He's very popular amongst certain circles in Vienna, which Franz Joseph just isn't. He's a very rigid, cold, conservative autocrat. So he channels Maximilian's energies into the Navy, appoints him commander-in-chief of the Austrian Navy. That sounds like a good gig. It's a bit of a joke. The Austrian Navy it never had a navy, really, and inherits some dilapidated Venetian ships after 1850, back to the settlement. And so it's a sort of, it's a way of giving him an impressive sounding title, Commander-in-Chief of the Austrian Navy, but at the same time, keeping him out of Vienna and in a position where he can never seriously challenge Franz Joseph to power. Now, this is not actually, well, to be fair to Maximilian, he actually really embraces this naval career. He loves the sea, he loves the Navy, and he does a good job reforming it and modernizing it. But it's not what he thinks he's destined for. He's been brought up on tales of Habsburg, you know, heroism, derring-do, and power. And but for 18 months, he thinks that should be his destiny in Austria, and it never will be. And what steals that, his determination, his ambition, is his wife. So this is Princess Charlotte of Belgium, known in and subsequently in Mexican history as Carlota. She's the daughter of King Leopold, and on her mother's side, she's related to the French, the French king. So illustrious birth, but part of this new constitutional monarchy of Belgium. So she, again, she's somebody who's fiercely ambitious, precociously talented. She's a great linguist. She's really interested in history and philosophy. But as an aristocratic woman in the 19th century, her way to power is through marriage. And so when Maximilian rocks up to the Belgian court on a diplomatic mission, she's taken instantly. She's sort of 16, 17 year old, very, very young. Maximilian's tall, blue eyes, about 6 foot, striking, blonde hair. He has a very strategic beard covering the Habsburg chin, which I think probably helps his appearance, if you know anything about the Habsburgs. And so Carlotta sort of hitches her wagon to his, as it were. But she's absolutely convinced of Maximilian's greatness as well. He is briefly given an important position in the Austrian Empire as governor of Lombardy, Venetia, but to cut a long story short, that ends in disaster. His brother sacks him, humiliates him, and then France invades northern Italy, and then humiliates Franz Joseph. So by the end of the 1850s, beginning the 1860s, you've got Maximilian living the life of a dilettante. He writes poetry, he's interested in botany, but what he really believes is that he's destined to rule and to rule as a great monarch. His wife believes that even more than he does. He's constructed a fairy tale castle for himself, as you do as an aristocrat with too much money and not enough to do. And it's an extraordinary sort of neo-Gothic fairy tale affair overlooking the Adriatic. You could, and a wonderful place to visit. But Carlotta says, and thinks, our life there is just going to be staring out to sea from this barren rock until old age. It's going to be boring. So when Mexican monarchies, backed by Napoleon III, Emperor of the French, come to Maximilian in October of 1861 and say, would you like to be Emperor of Mexico? He says, absolutely. This is what I've been looking for. He's Catholic. He's a Habsburg. The Habsburgs was Charles V who Mexico was first subjugated under the Spanish Empire. So you have that connection. But it's his availability more than anything else. I mean, other candidates are considered. Maximilian has always told him, it was always you. Others are considered, but he's the one who is sort of ideally placed to accept this position, which is at this stage imaginary. It doesn't exist. There's no formal offer they can give him because Mexico at this stage is not a monarchy, but he's interested and he accepts.
But it takes him forever to get there, which, I mean, his pushy wife as well. Why does it take so long for him to actually get to Mexico?
It's a great question. So he's the first informal offer comes in October 1861. He doesn't go to Mexico until May 1864, nearly 3 years. So why does it take so long? Well, there's two things. One, what's happening on the ground in Mexico, and two, Maximilian's own character. So let's zoom back to Mexico.
I just, like, at this point, I'm like, it's probably all these fecking COVID tests and lateral
things. Exactly. It's like, just the quarantine rules, right? Yeah. And actually, well, in Veracruz, which is the principal border in Mexico, it was yellow fever, which was a particularly horrific disease, especially for those people who have no exposure or immunity to it. So he's worried about yellow fever, but that's not what might take 3 years for him to get there. So the Mexican monarchists have told Napoleon III, this is going to be easy, don't worry. You just essentially need to turn up, show the French flag, and Mexico rally to this plan. You won't be surprised to learn that's not what happens. Benito Juarez is the legitimate president. He won the civil war, so he defeated the people who are arguing for monarchy. And instead of the nation rallying to the French flag, rather unsurprisingly, you might think, they rally to the Mexican flag, which is defended by the legitimate government of Mexico. Benito Juarez was actually elected into power in 1861. So you can't get more legitimate as a president than Benito. Still, Napoleon III, he realizes pretty quickly, French forces arrive in January 1862, he realizes this is not going to be as easy as he thought. He sends reinforcements, still only about 6,000, that march inland after some various diplomatic shenanigans towards the second city of Mexico, a place called Puebla. Now, Puebla is Mexican monarchists are telling Napoleon all kinds of things. They tell him that this is a bastion of Catholicism and monarchism. And so the French commander of this small expeditionary force launches an attack head on into the city. Doesn't invest in the sea, doesn't spend a long time doing artillery bombardment, nothing like that. He thinks it's going to be easy. It isn't. He's defeated after a sort of heroic defense by the Mexican army. And people might be familiar with this date because it's on the 5th of May, 1862, otherwise known as Cinco de Mayo. So if you're ever out there knocking back some tequila and wondering what you're drinking tequila for, it's because of this famous battle that the Mexican army defeats the French army, defeats the army of Bonaparte. And remember that this is the army that defeated the Russians.
Zach's actually celebrating. Look,
he's celebrating. It defeated the army. Defeated the French army. The French army defeated the Russians in the Crimean War. It defeated the Austrians in 1859. This is an absolutely extraordinary event, not just because it's the French army, but any European army being defeated outside of Europe is an extremely rare event. So, if you are drinking tequila to celebrate this, then have another one because it really is a moment where that sets the tone, right? So this is not the sort of gentle, leisurely stroll up to Mexico City that was expected. Napoleon III sends reinforcements, 25,000 men. So now you've got about 30,000 French troops in Mexico. You do have some Mexican monarchists who join that force as well. That overwhelms Juarez, and he's forced to abandon the capital. But not till the summer of 1863 do the French get into Mexico City. So the short answer to your question, that was rather a long rambling one, is that it takes a year and a half for the French to fight their way to Mexico City. They then orchestrate a puppet government that supposedly in the name of people is Maximilian. Maximilian receives that formal offer in October 1863. Understandably now, he's slightly reticent to accept it because he realizes that he's not going to be acclaimed popularly by the Mexican people. And so there's a huge amount of vacillation. And this is a key part of his character. He's a dreamer. And the idea of being Emperor of Mexico is magnificent. And I'm sure, you know, we can all fantasize about being the Emperor of Mexico. Actually, becoming Emperor of Mexico in a brutal, bloody civil war was slightly less attractive. And this is where Carlotta comes in, because she steals him. She adds her determination to him and says, look, we're going. The bags are packed. You know, you just need to get on with it. He still vacillates, he cries. He suffers, he suffers a lot from anxiety and has what we would say mental health problems. So it's not quite he's not quite as gung-ho as she would like him to be. But eventually, after much backwards and forwards, he does embark from Mexico, and as you say, gets there in May of 1864, nearly 3 years after this plan was first discussed.
So you have a French army basically invading a sovereign nation in the name of a cause that, with the best will in the world, doesn't have popular support. This is, I'm going to take a step back and say, obviously, it's more complicated than that. But if you wanted to draw a direct line between Napoleon I and Napoleon III, you could do this quite easily. So what's the international reaction like? The French just seem to be involving themselves in these affairs. Obviously, the British are very good at this kind of thing anyway, but that's kind of part of the problem, right? That the British consider themselves the masters of getting involved and exerting their influence in territory. And the French going and doing that presumably doesn't go down too well. So how does the rest of Europe respond to what the French are doing here?
Well, it's an interesting question. And actually, those Napoleonic parallels are made at the time, and Spain being the obvious one, putting people onto thrones. Well, from Napoleonic path, it doesn't normally end well. Actually, in Europe, the reaction is surprisingly positive. So this began as a joint intervention with Spain and Britain. Britain and Spain, as soon as they realized that regime change is Napoleon III's plan, and by the way, he kept that secret from them. He thought they would just get behind it when they turn up. And as soon as they realize what he's up to, they disassociate themselves from it. But in power in Britain is Palmerston. Now, Palmerston is very anti-American. He absolutely shares Napoleon III's geopolitical rationale for this intervention, which is that if the European powers don't support Mexico, it will eventually be absorbed by the United States of America, and that's going to be a bad thing for European power, if you think of things in those kind of realpolitik, balance of power conceptions. So Palmerston says it's an absurd scheme. If Britain was to get involved, you'd need 20, 30,000 troops, you'd need tens of millions of pounds, what is a huge amount of money in those days. There's no way we're going to do it. But if the French want to do it, it will benefit us. So he, there's actually a number of moments, because one of the conditions Maximilian puts on his exception is that Britain must support it too. If Britain and France are behind it, as you say, then things are going to happen. Thompson stops short of that, but what he prevents his foreign secretary, Lord Russell, from writing to Maximilian saying the British government will never back this, because he actually wants this to happen, to succeed. The other thing you have to bear in mind is that, you know, in mid-19th century, the idea of republican democratic government is quite a dangerous one to a lot of European statesmen. Well, I say quite a very dangerous idea to a lot of European statesmen. So when you go to Lord Palmerston, you say, well, would it be better to have a monarchy or a republic in Mexico? He absolutely agrees a monarchy would be a much better solution. But if it can be done without British involvement, then they will give sort of tacit support, and they do recognize Maximilian's empire. And of course, Austria as well, that gives support. Belgium, for what it's worth, gives support, recognizes the empire, allows volunteers to be recruited. So the European situation for Maximilian is pretty good. The problem he has is with the United States of America. And the only reason any of this has been allowed to unfold is because, of course, there is a civil war in the United States of America that breaks out almost immediately after the Mexican one ends. And in a way, you can think of this period as a sort of decade of conflict across the continent of North America, which massively impacts on the future of how those that region is going to be governed. Now, while the United States of America is torn between the Confederacy and the Union, Washington cannot enforce something called the Monroe Doctrine. The Monroe Doctrine, in it very briefly, forbids any European intervention of exactly this kind in Latin America. But Washington's fear, Lincoln's fear, Abraham Lincoln, president, and his Secretary of State, William Seward, their fear is, well, if we push too hard against what the French are doing in Mexico, the French might recognize the Confederacy as a independent nation. Worse still, they might lend economic aid and worst case scenario of all, military aid, right? That conflict is in the balance at this period. So there is a small window, and that's absolutely Napoleon III's gamble. He knows that, and that's why he launches it in 1861. There's a small window in which the Mexican Empire might be able to consolidate itself free from US pressure and interference. Maximilian doesn't have popular support, but he does have some support. There are people in Mexico, as I say, especially within the conservative section of Mexican politics, who are hugely opposed to Benito Juarez and his reforms. They believe that the attacks on the Catholic Church are impious, that Juarez's liberal vision for Mexico is incredibly damaging. And so you're absolutely right to say he's not going to win an election, but there are tens of thousands of people who rallied to the Imperialista banner. Imperialista is the name of supporters given to Maximilian. So in 1864, he's got French support, he's got foreign volunteers from Belgium and Austria, and he's got he has support in Mexico, albeit contested, and certainly not the majority.
So he's not completely hated, but
he's not
received when he gets there.
Well, so he's the one characteristic of Maximilian. It's very easy to paint him as this sort of bumbling idiot who is constantly prevaricating over decisions. He's charismatic. He wins over a lot of people from the Liberal Party, in fact, because he himself considers himself a liberal, a moderate liberal, someone who believes in what he would call the spirit of the age of progress. He's not a dyed-in-the-wool reactionary trying to support the Catholic Church or Spanish colonialism. And once he explains that in person, he's very good in person to leading politicians in Mexico. Some very big names actually come across. Some of Juarez's own supporters urge him to resign. They say, we're never going to defeat the French army in open battle. Not now, they've got 30,000 troops there. And Maximilian actually confirms a huge number of the very liberal reforms that Benito Juarez had been fighting for in the civil war that we mentioned. So he's not universally hated. But of course, if you are, dyed-in-the-wool supporter of the president Benito Juarez, you are never going to accept the change of political system. So one of the major problems he faces is that civil war is rumbling on. Benito Juarez is never defeated. He just retreats. Mexico is enormous. I think five times the size of France. And it's twice as big as the area of Algeria that the French army is currently brutally pacifying, in inverted commas. But with far fewer troops that the French have in Mexico in order to accomplish that. So they have those problems. That the government of Benito Juarez is legitimate, it's undefeated, it has popular support. The other problem Maximilian has, aside from the growing US pressure, is that his treasury is bankrupt. Napoleon III, and this is probably another typical Napoleonic trick, has essentially leveraged the conquest of Mexico and put it on the Mexican government that he has installed. So it's costing hundreds of millions of francs, and that's not going to be paid for out of the French treasury. That's going to be extracted from the Mexican treasury. It's essentially a loan, and additional loans are taken out by Maximilian. So he's bankrupt. He's in the midst of a civil war. And once the US deals with the Confederacy, he's going to face serious international opposition.
There's just an echo there of, I'm going to build a wall and then get the Mexicans to pay for it. not that I'm drawing comparisons between Trump and Napoleon III, because Napoleon III actually had a modicum of intelligence at the very least. Well, no, he had more than a modicum of intelligence, actually. I'm being trolly, but... Anyway, I want to jump in with a counterfactual just whilst we're sort of talking about the situation more broadly in the North American continent. And I'm thinking about what Alex was saying earlier about the Zimmerman telegram and the whole fact about the Mexico losing California to the US earlier in the century. In a world where all of this doesn't happen, would there have been any appetite within Mexico to capitalize on the anarchy that's going on in the US to then march in and start annexing bits of the US whilst the US is trying to fight a civil war? And therefore, because of this, what happens in the US manages to play out in the way that it does?
That's a really interesting question. I think that the answer to that would be no. Insofar as Mexico's relations with the Union, with President Lincoln. President Lincoln is very sympathetic towards Mexico, and in a way that counterfactual is a shame. It's a shame that this happens when it does, because Lincoln would have reset relations with Mexico. Lincoln was very opposed to the US-Mexican war. He voted against it. He saw it for what it was, which was an illegal war. The president deliberately misled Congress to get them to declare war. And he was known as Spotty Lincoln because before, obviously, he became slightly better known for his role in the US Civil War, because the president, it was President Polk, had said that border skirmish had happened in US territory, US troops had died. That was the reason why the US had gone to war. And Lincoln would always say, show me the spot, full well knowing that the spot was actually inside Mexican territory. And therefore, the entire rationale for the war was illegal. Their relations between Benito Juarez and the Republican Party, which back in those days was a very different party to the one that we have today, I'm sure your listeners will know, was very positive, actually. And I think for that reason, there wouldn't have been that tension, because those relations would have been, in fact, it's a real high point of relations between the Mexican Republic, Benito Juarez, and the US Republic after the US Civil War, which is slightly skewed by the assassination of Lincoln, and the next president is less interested or sympathetic towards Mexican affairs. But I think where what you might have seen had the French not invaded is you would have seen active Mexican support for the Union against the Confederacy. Because if you think about it, that what's pushing that expansion, that southward expansion of the United States of America, is that southern constituency, which is looking for more land, more slave states to encompass. And so there was no love, as you'd expect, in Mexico for that view of manifest destiny. Slavery had been made illegal in Mexico in 1829. So the Confederacy might well have had a much harder time of it, in fact, had it not been for the French intervention in Mexico.
So, you've mentioned he's got supporters. There are conservatives who value the concept of Maximilian coming in and being emperor and stuff. But he goes and cocks this up, doesn't he?
That's one way of putting it. Well, Maximilian's a man of enormous contradictions. And he tries to rule Mexico as he imagined he would do it in his mind, which is this enlightened, as I say, sort of moderate liberal, in a sense, trying to recreate what Napoleon III is doing in 1860s France, which is moving much more towards the center and away from the authoritarian empire he creates in the 1850s. The problem with that is the people who do support him have called him to reign as a Catholic, traditional figure, you know, and his opponents are called reactionary. They want the pomp and ceremony of monarchy. And what Maximilian does is he tries to appeal to Mexican nationalists, Mexican liberals, by dressing in traditional Mexican costumes. He's wearing a sombrero. He's wearing what, you know, we would essentially consider to be kind of cowboy getup. When you call the most illustrious European dynasty, you know, trace its power back to the medieval period, you don't expect them to turn up, you know, with a lasso and a big cowboy saddle and a sombrero, which is what Maximilian does. The fact that he confirms a lot of Juarez's liberal reforms further alienates his constituency, right? Because the whole reason that they continued the civil war was to end the liberal reforms that Benito Juarez had brought in against the Catholic Church. The key one being what his diehard supporters expect is that as soon as he comes, he will restore the property to the church that was confiscated under Benito Juarez's liberals. He doesn't. He confirms the sale of the church property. And so although that does bring on some, what I suppose it's kind of harsh sort of fair weather liberals, but certainly some moderate liberals do come on board, it alienates his constituents. The people who would go down to the death fighting for him and actually do in the end up go down to the death fighting with him. And it fails to bring on board enough supporters on that moderate liberal side who don't want an ersatz European constitutional monarchy version of the radical liberalism that they fought and died for in Benito Juarez. So he does fail to win over a significant constituency in Mexico, absolutely.
And then he goes and gets stabbed in the back by a little guy called Napoleon. Who'd have thought that, you know, a guy in Napoleon?
Do you know what would, kind of family, you know, what makes it even funnier, Ed, that Zach so loves watching Napoleon, the Napoleon family, the Bonapartes fail, is that fate has gifted him a girlfriend who is literally obsessed with Napoleon number one. Absolutely obsessed. Yeah. And like, you can't even say, yeah, but he killed his whole army in Egypt. It was a gift. No, I know, but he owns it. I love it.
Yeah. If the Bonaparte's propaganda is incredibly effective, and that's, yeah, you know, and that's part of the reason why Napoleon III is able to become Napoleon III, because so many people in France by 1848 were thinking like Zach's girlfriend. They just remember the good times. They just remember the good times.
Napoleon III had
done everything he could to get Maximilian to go to Mexico, right? Because it would have been a difficult policy to sell anyway. To have spent hundreds of millions of francs and then for your emperor not to turn up would have been a bad look. So he spends a lot of energy and political capital getting Maximilian there. One of the things he says to him is that, you know, don't worry, my support for you will never fail. He puts that in writing. So it's a bit of a shock to Maximilian when his support does fail. And the reason for this is because, well, there's a number of reasons. One is US pressure. The United States of America all but threatened France with war unless they pull their forces out. They can now enforce the Monroe Doctrine, the civil war's finished. Two, the difficulty of defeating the heroic resistance of Benito Juarez. It's not been the walk in the park. He was promised by Mexican monarchists, if it's going to work, it's going to become another Algeria. And that's the whole reason he embarked on this, was because he didn't want another Algeria. This was going to be empire on the cheap. And thirdly, Maximilian has proved himself to be a rather ineffectual ruler, much more interested in creating academies of arts and sciences, reforming education, giving rights to workers. Now, this is all great stuff. What Napoleon III wants is the finances organized and the payments made that were agreed before Maximilian left. That's not happening. So Maximilian has to ask Napoleon III for a bit of credit. He can't afford to pay what he's been asked to do. So Napoleon III seizes on this as a pretext and says, aha, you agreed to pay these monthly payments, you're not going to pay them. In reality, it's really the US pressure and the continued resistance of Benito Juarez. He announces something that's probably quite familiar to us these days, a phased withdrawal. He's going to take his troops out, but he's not going to take them out immediately. He announces this January 1866. The plan is that they will leave in three blocks and the final troops will leave at the end of 1867. The idea being that he's fulfilled his obligations to the United States of America, he's getting his troops out, but he's going to give Maximilian basically 2 years in which his regime can consolidate with continued French financial and military support. So he does abandon him, and Maximilian is furious and initially says that he will abdicate. But Napoleon III at this point still can massage it in the court of public opinion to say, well, I'm giving him a chance. he then quickly goes back on that as well. So there's more, but Bonaparte is perfidiousness, if that's the word, to come.
I think Asquith says perfidity. I don't know if it's an actual word, but I've definitely seen that when he's complaining about the Italians.
Yeah. Some kind of betrayal, let's call it that. Or
see, we have a phrase that we tend to use on History Hack called shithousery, which I think possibly covers it.
Yeah,
that's the technical term.
It is.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, so what I'd say it's to paint it in even worse light, just in case anyone out there is still rooting for Napoleon III. Carlotta, Maximilian decides to abdicate once he realizes the French support is going. He thinks, well, I can't do this. On my own, and the empire is not consolidated enough. He says, I'll abdicate. Now, Carlotta, when she hears this, is furious. She is absolutely adamant that he won't abdicate. She tells him in no uncertain terms, and indeed so keen is she to get the point across, she actually writes a long memorandum. She accuses him of a cowardice. She says that kings in the medieval age at least waited until people took their states. And she says, as long as there's an emperor, even if he's only occupied 6 feet, there will still be an empire, i.e. you go down fighting.
I love now, this. This is essentially if your wife writes a feckin' memorandum to you to explain why you're being a dick, you back down, don't you?
Absolutely. He does. And he's quite shocked by it, but also buoyed by it, because, as I say, he's plunged into despair. She's so confident that they can turn it around that it does buoy Maximilian. And she also says, and also don't worry about the French abandoning us, because I will go to Paris, I will speak to Napoleon III in person, and I will remind him to his face with the written letters that I will take with me with his signature on, saying that I will never abandon you, my support will not fail.
She crowned herself empress.
She should have done, yeah. And actually, Maximilian was, he was dubbed the royal tourist because he was really into botany and natural science. He loved touring Mexico and sort of cataloguing butterflies and things like that. And so he'd be away for, which is not great use of time, given the country is in the midst of civil war. But while he was away, Carlotta would rule in Mexico City as regent, and almost universally from Mexican politicians to French generals much prefer it when she was in power, because it decisive action was taken and she was much more competent than he was. But of course, it wasn't a long-term solution. She decides to go back to France. Now, Napoleon III, no one likes to be reminded of their mistakes, and least of all foreign policy mistakes that are costing the lives of
At least of all a Bonaparte.
At least of all a Bonaparte. So Napoleon III first tries to say, I'm sick. I'm really sorry, but I'm not feeling well. We can't meet. She then says, if I don't care, I'll break into the Tuileries. I will find you.
I love this woman. I love her. She's like, I'm sick of men and their shithousery. I will fix this.
Yeah, I will. So she eventually shames him into a meeting. And in that meeting, Napoleon III, he's very sorry. He breaks out in tears. It's at the point that Carlotta brings out a letter saying, my support will never fail you. But there's nothing he can do. His hands are tied. So he's not going to risk war with the United States of America. He's not that much of a gambler. And it's really, the game is up as far as he's concerned. And then what happens in that meeting, which is sort of a strategic mistake on Carlotta's point of view, is she still has this faith that Napoleon III is an honest guy and is telling the truth. And so she says, it's your ministers. I understand now. It's your ministers who have talked you into this policy. I will have meetings with them, convince them, and then they will come back to you, and then they will tell you that yes, we made a mistake and we can continue to support. So it's a great, yes, absolutely, I will set up all of those meetings, I'll give you rooms, whatever you want. Of course, full well knowing that his ministers are not going to listen to her. She's a 24-year-old Belgian princess who's part of a foreign policy disaster for France. So those meetings are predictably, they're very polite, yes, but no. And Napoleon III is then able to present to her a fait accompli that there is going to be no more support. Now, Carlos has got one final trick up her sleeve, which is to go to the Pope in Rome, because Catholic Mexico has been alienated by Maximilian's liberalism. If they can agree a concordat with the papacy, then that will rally Catholic Mexico. I mean, he said Mexico, which I guess is probably what Maximilian wanted to call it. Rally Catholic Mexico behind the empire, and perhaps that will turn the Juarista tide, which is by now circling and beginning to encircle Mexico City. So she goes to the Vatican and she has a preliminary meeting with the Pope to try and come to an agreement. She spends the hour and a half not discussing church-state relations, as you'd expect, but accusing her entourage and Mexican politicians who traveled with her of trying to poison her on the orders of Napoleon III. She thinks that he has hired assassins to kill her. She begins to see Napoleon III as a devil incarnate. She calls him the principle of evil upon earth, which some people might agree with. But it's not through any rational deduction. And of course, it's entirely untrue. Napoleon III is not trying to poison her. She is beginning to lose her mind, whether it be the pressure of the mission that she put upon herself or some longer term problem, we don't know. And this the upshot of this is a denouement in the most dramatic of fashion. So she's meant to have a follow-up meeting with the Pope a few days later, but she doesn't wait for that. One morning she demands that her servants drive her to the Vatican. She bursts in unannounced again, throwing that force of personality, and said, "I want to see the Pope, and I want to see him now." And the Pope, of course, it's early in the morning, there's no appointment. What do? You just go and see a Belgian princess early in the morning as a Pope?
Don't fuck with this woman.
Well, exactly. I think that's what he decides. So he says, "Okay, fine, I'll meet with her." But she breaks down in tears, sobbing uncontrollably in the corridors of the Vatican, screaming that Napoleon III is trying to poison her. And she's lost all reason, and he's absolutely convinced that his assassins are, she only plays should be safe is in the Vatican. She refuses to leave. She spends the night there, which I think is not allowed, although I'm sure it's happened many a time, having princesses stay in the Vatican. And there's so many long stories that need to be cut short in this tale. She's only eventually bundled out, and she the next day, she's so hungry. She won't eat anything because she thinks it will have been poisoned. But she sees a sort of vat of stew bubbling away, and there's kitchens in the convent adjacent to the Vatican. Plunges her hand in to bring it out, and the pain of that causes her to pass out. So she's then bundled out of the Vatican. I mean, the papers are going, great, now we can get her out. And they bundled her out, and then she goes back to her hotel room where she sequesters herself away, still convinced that people are trying to poison her. So she won't eat anything apart from oranges, which she peels herself, or nuts. And I suppose those are good things to worry about poison. And then eventually she insists that live chickens be slaughtered in front of her and then cooked so that she can watch the entire preparation process. It's a really tragic tale because she's completely lost her mind at this stage, and she has to be rescued by her Belgian family, who come and take her away and take her back initially to Maximilian's fairy tale castle, where she convalesces. Back to Mexico, Maximilian has no idea about this. There is a transatlantic cable that's been laid that doesn't work very well, so most communication 4 to 6 weeks. When he hears that Carlotta has had this breakdown, he decides to abdicate for a second time.
Yeah, he's not going to do it without her, is he?
He's not going to do it without her.
He's a butterfly collecting wuss. He's not. He's not up for civil war without his wife.
I'm not being funny though, but why hasn't he learned from the first round? If she wrote a memorandum when he suggested it the first time, what's she going to do when she recovers and then finds that while she's been convalescing, he's gone and abdicated? This guy isn't thinking, is he?
No, well,
this hasn't thought this plan through.
By this point, Maximilian himself is isolated. Most of his sort of friends, people he knew from Europe, have gone back to Europe. He's got some close advisors and Mexican officers who he does trust, but he's increasingly isolated. And without Carlotta, one of the things about Maximilian is he doesn't like the social side of monarchy. So Carlotta was great at that, holding reception halls and things like that. Without her in Mexico, he increasingly retreats into this interior world, this sort of vast palaces of residency he's sort of done up for himself, seeing fewer and fewer people. And although he initially does decide to abdicate, and if you do read the book, you won't be surprised to learn, and that's a decision that he agonizes over for many, many days. And after 40 days of agonizing, he eventually decides not to. And the reason that he decides to go back on his decision to abdicate is partially because of what you said about Carlotta. It's partially his conception of honor. He's obsessed by honor. He wakes up every morning, and I think he asks himself, what would be honorable? What would a household do? And the answer to that question is not abdicate. His conservative supporters in Mexico, now they have him isolated, and now that the liberal forces are resurgent, and the liberal program is over, there's no point pursuing that. So they convince him that there'll be huge support if he just backs what he should have done the whole time, their conservative and Catholic policies. And actually, one of the final people that persuades him to stay is a British diplomat, British minister to Mexico, who who similarly says it would be dishonourable to abdicate. So this is the point where Britain comes in and has some opprobrium on it, because Maximilian is a massive Anglophile, and he thinks that if the British diplomat is telling him to stay, that's because the British government wants him to stay. Now, the British government are horrified when they learn what this diplomat has said, and he gets into quite a lot of trouble, because of reasons we'll see. But Maximilian, because of honour, because of his hatability, because of Carlotta, because of the persuasiveness of his conservative allies, thinks, okay, fine, the French are leaving, but I've got this. I'm going to rally the empire and my supporters and overcome the increasingly victorious liberal forces that are beginning to converge on all parts of his empire.
So how does it all go wrong? What's the final chapter like?
What could go wrong? Well, it's important. By this point, you know, we're talking about an empire, and it sounds such a grandiose word. We're just talking about Mexico City, which is admittedly an enormous and fantastic city. You can see its imperial grandeur. I mean, it was the capital of one of the most wealthy parts of the Spanish Empire in the 16th century. So he controls that. He controls Veracruz, which is the main Atlantic port. He controls Puebla, the town, the city that, that the French had so much trouble taking, and a few more towns to the northwest of Mexico. The rest of Mexico is in Carlista hands. His conservative allies tell him that we can make one last desperate stand against Juaristas, who are all converging on a town called Querétaro. Now, Querétaro, it's believed to be an imperialista stronghold because it's deeply Catholic churches and convents. And so the plan is we'll march what remains of the imperial army out to this town, meet up with imperialista forces there. There are three Juarista armies converging, but not at the same time. So we can defeat them separately. Glorious triumph. The French are not involved in this, so no one can say this was foreign intervention. And Maximilian will be, you know, this hero. People flock to him. Now, I think that it's, if anyone ever says, well, I think what we need to do is one last desperate stand, which if we win, we'll convince everyone that this is definitely the option to support. It's not a great plan. A lot goes wrong with it, not least Maximilian appoints himself commander-in-chief of the army. He's never served in the army. He was a naval man. In fact, military matters used to bore him as a child, let alone commanded one. So putting Maximilian, who's indecisive, he's now suffering from fevers, he's got dysentery, he's taking opium pills for the pain. In charge of this army, he's probably not the man you want leading you. Also, the imperialist forces now, so the force that he leads to Querétaro, it's about 1,500 men. Now, and these people have been pressed ganged off the streets of Mexico City. These are not veterans of the Civil War. The conservatives say, we'll get you tens of billions of dollars. They have $50,000, which is not a lot of money in today. And it would be a bit more then, but it's not enough to provision an army. $50,000, 1,500 men. They march to this town, Querétaro. They meet up with some more imperialist forces. And these are veterans and these are better trained. He's got about 9,000 men. Juaristas have got at least 30,000. So what very quickly happens is the town is put under siege. That plan to decisively march out and defeat each army separately, that gets put to committee, debated, and by the time they come to a decision, it's too late. He's under siege. Now they hold out. And at this point, I think at least in Maximilian's mind, he is the heroic Habsburg leader that he's always dreamt of being. He shows incredible bravery. He leads from the front. He's under fire. They're not sleeping. Querétaro is a disastrous place to be under siege on sides of the hills, which the Juaristas occupy with their artillery. Shells are raining down day after day. They're running out of food and they're beginning to starve. But as I say, there's heroic resistance. The plan is to break out because desertion is becoming a problem and there's no food after 70 days of siege. The plan is to break out the 13th of May, delayed. The plan is to break out on the 14th of May, delayed. On the night of the 14th of May, so this is Maximilian's modus operandi as commander-in-chief, delay. Which is, you know, I suppose it occasionally works in military history, but not in this situation. On the night of the 14th, he brings in one of his most loyal Mexican lieutenants, a guy called Miguel Lopez. He awards him a medal for bravery. Maximilian is actually a godfather to one of Lopez's children. And he says to Lopez, when we break out, if it looks like I'm going to be captured, you need to put a bullet through my head. I don't want to be taken alive. Lopez is like, see, that'll be fine. Maximilian goes to bed. 5 a.m. wakes up. Lopez and his men burst into the convent, which they've made their citadel, their headquarters. And he says, the enemy are, you know, at the gates, but you know, get out, escape. Lopez disappears. there's confusion, chaos within the headquarters as Maximilian and his closest entourage sort of desperately make to get out of the convent. They get across the courtyard and they get to the gates of the convent. They're stopped by Far Eastern soldiers who've broken in through their lines. And then the officer looks over the emperor, so-called emperor, of course, because he wouldn't have recognized him as such, and his entourage, and says, "Let these men pass, they're civilians." Now that's very odd, we might come back to that. And what Maximilian now decides to do is make his way to a place called the Hill of the Bells. This overlooks the town. There's a garrison up there. He thinks he can rally his forces, and he sort of artillery fire raining down upon him as he scrambles up this hill, and he looks down and he sees the town surrendering below him. So eventually he has to send an officer down with a white flag, and he does surrender. Now, what's happened is that Lopez, instead of putting a bullet through Maximilian's head as he asked if he was about to be captured, he's actually gone over to the Juarista lines that very night and betrayed the emperor. And he leads a small force of Juaristas into the town. He gets the Imperialista guards to stand down. Of course, they see one of Maximilian's closest officers telling them to go somewhere else or to point the artillery elsewhere, and they obey him. So he's been betrayed in this final moment, in this final siege, and he's taken prisoner.
What a hell of a story. We've run out of time, which is really annoying because I would love to sit here for another hour and bash Napoleon III and talk about this guy, Maximilian, and just such a bizarre guy, just such a bad choice, really, as an emperor.
I know you're already desperate to get Ed back to do a podcast just about Napoleon III.
Oh, well, we absolutely should do that.
Oh, yes. But Ed, thank you so much for joining us. This has been an absolute riot. I've loved it in my smug way. So The Last Emperor of Mexico, A Disaster in the New World, will be out by the time that this goes out. Folks, we'll stick it on the History Hack bookstore. Check the links in the description. You'll be able to find it. Go buy it. Because you've just had a flavour of the hilarity that is this story. So, Ed, thank you so much.
Not at all. No, it's been hugely enjoyable. Thank you.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So, to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.